more or less what I have promised. The talk is based on joint works with Sanjeev Haro and Boaz Barak and Prasad Raghavendra. It's two papers. And okay. So the talk will be about the new games problem. So we saw it already a couple of times, but just remind ourselves. So it's a constraint satisfaction problem. We have variables x1 to xn. And the alphabet is the set of numbers from 1 to k. And we have constraints over these variables that have the form xi minus xj equal to c modulo k. And the goal is to find the assignment that satisfies as many of the constraints as possible. Okay. And so it's not important that the constraints have this algebraic form, but what's important about the constraints is that they have this uniqueness property that for every value here, there's a unique value for the other variable that satisfies the constraint. Okay. And, what happened? Okay, so sorry about that. Somehow by accident I deleted the slide. So the Nagel's conjecture is about the hardness of approximating the Nagel's problem. So concretely, it says that for every epsilon, for every positive constant epsilon, the following problem is NP-hard. You're given a unique games instance that has alphabet size which is not too large, and for completeness, it's just say that the alphabet size is equal to log n. And the conjecture asserts that it's NP-hard to distinguish between the case that the instance that more than one minus epsilon of the constraints can be satisfied in the instance, and the case that at most epsilon of the constraints in the instance can be satisfied. Where? Here? Yeah. The number of variables. We have variables x1 to xn. And so we'll be interested in this promise problem, and I refer to it as unique games with parameter epsilon and denoted in this way. Okay. So the unique games conjecture asserts that for every positive constant epsilon, this problem unique games with parameter epsilon is NP-hard. And the reason why we're interested in this conjecture is because it has very strong and surprising implications. In particular, it implies that, for example, it is NP-hard to beat the best known approximation algorithms for problems like MaxCut. Okay. And maybe just a remark which is sort of relevant for this talk is that this is not really like all or nothing kind of implications. So what these implications really show is that unique games is some kind of barrier. So independent of the truth of the unique games conjecture, the unique games problem is some kind of barrier for many of these optimization problems, in the sense that, for example, if you look at the problem of, if you want to beat the Grimmins-Williamson approximation for MaxCut by some amount epsilon, then this problem is as hard as solving unique games with parameter epsilon prime. Epsilon prime depends in some way on epsilon. Okay. And so in this sense, the unique games problem is a common barrier for improving current algorithms. And so the question is really what, and of course these results are, the meaningfulness of these results depends on the hardness of the unique games problem. And so we want to understand how hard this unique games problem is. And what we show is that the problem is not as hard as you might expect. We show that unique games from epsilon can be approximated in time exponentially in n to the epsilon to the 1/3. Okay, and maybe more generally, there's some trade-off between the running time and the approximation guarantee that you can achieve. So if you want to achieve this kind of approximation guarantee that, given an instance where you can satisfy 1 minus epsilon of the constraints, you want to find an assignment that satisfies 1 minus c times root epsilon of the constraints. And there's an algorithm whose running time it depends on this factor and on this vector c. So if you choose c larger, then the running time of the algorithm improves drastically. Okay. So maybe to see why it's just maybe to explain a bit why you might not expect that this problem has this kind of an algorithm. Let's see what we know for other problems. Okay, so. If you look at so in general, there's this we can there are problems that can be solved in polynomial time, and problems like threesat, which we believe should require exponential time. And there are, you know, also approximation problems which you can solve in polynomial time. And then there are approximation problems which are known to be as hard as 3-sat in a very strong sense, in the sense that if 3-sat requires exponential time, then also all these problems require exponential time. And in some sense, all NP-hardness results for constraint satisfaction problems, they don't just show NP-hardness, but they actually show this kind of strong NP-hardness. It's really it is as hard as 3-sat in the sense. And there's this big wide space in between this exponential time and polynomial time. And maybe some famous examples of problems that might fall in here is factoring and graph isomorphism. But none of these problems are really of the same type as these problems. And what we show is the Gini games from an epsilon falls to the left of this point. Okay. And maybe a remark about cyber-exponential algorithms. So it's not true that, you know, all NP-hard problems are exponentially hard. There might be natural NP-hard problems which can be solved in time which looks better than this. But the question is really sometimes what is the right notion of n. So n is here not really the instance size, but the number of variables in the instance. So this is important. What's the right parameter of n, and also it's important sort of what kind of improvement of approximation guarantee you want to you're aiming at. So if you want to improve the approximation guarantee by some small amount, then some enumeration is likely to help. But here we want to improve the approximation by some epsilon fraction. So in this sense, it is unexpected that this problem has this kind of running time. Okay. And so one concrete open question is now what happens to this problem, beating Gremmings-Williamson approximation for max cut by some epsilon amount. So we know that it is harder than Gini games with parameter epsilon. So it somehow has to be to the right of this point, but the question is if it's close to this point or maybe it is exponentially hard. But then if it would be exponentially hard, then somehow you couldn't show this using Gini games based on the Gini games conjecture. Okay. Now some concrete consequences for the Gini games conjecture is that the kind of reductions if you want to prove an NP-hard if you want to prove the NP-hardness of this problem, then the reduction has to have a blow-up that grows as a large polynomial in n. It can't be a bounded polynomial. It can't be a polynomial of bounded degree. The degree has to depend on this parameter epsilon, and this rules out certain popular ways of NP-hardness reductions for constraint satisfaction problems. Okay, another consequence is that. So in many similar conjectures, you can choose epsilon to be subconstant. So we saw that in Dana's talks we saw exactly this, but somehow this result says that if you could choose epsilon here if you want to choose epsilon to be subconstant, then you have an algorithm that runs in time 2 to the n to the little o of 1, and it's unlikely to it's unlikely that any NP-hard problem has this kind of an algorithm. So it means that for subconstant epsilon, this problem is unlikely to be NP-hard. So what I want to talk about, I want to describe this algorithm in terms of seven different programming hierarchies. So these hierarchies, they were we already saw some about them in Ning's talk, and. So what I want to show is, what I want to explain is some kind of general framework for rounding CSPs using STP hierarchies. Okay. And this framework will work especially well for instances that are pseudo-random, in a certain technical sense, namely that the constraint graphs have few large eigenvalues. Okay. So this is the problem that we want to solve. And so let me give you an equivalent formulation of this problem. So equivalent, you can say that you want jointly distributed random variables x1 to xn, so distributed over each variable is distributed over over the set 1 to k. And you want that for a typical constraint in your CSP instance, you want that, you know, if you sample from the distribution, the constraint is satisfied with good probability. Okay. You know, so the existence of this kind of distribution is equivalent to, you know, to this optimization, you know, it's equivalent to the union against problem with parameter epsilon. And okay, so if you could find this kind of a distribution that, you know, if it exists, then that would solve the union against problem exactly. Now, SCP hierarchies, what they allow us to do, they allow us to find random variables that are similar to that, but in a certain local sense. Okay, so more concretely, so SCP hierarchies allow us to find random variables that are R-local, which I will define in a second, and satisfy this property. So R-local in particular does not imply that they are jointly distributed. And so we can find these kind of random variables in time and to the R using R levels of an SCP hierarchy. Okay, so now what are these R local random variables? So these R local random variables are specified by distributions over local assignments for all small sets of variables. Okay, so for every small set of variables, we have a distribution over the assignments to these variables. And these distributions are supposed to satisfy two properties. Okay, the first property is consistency. So that means that if we take, you know, the distribution for the variable set T and the distribution for the variable set S, and we look at the marginal of the distribution on the intersection of the two sets, then these marginals should be the same. Okay. The second condition is positive semidefiniteness. So it's not completely important what precise technical condition that I write here, but just basically, if you want to say that if you condition on any event that doesn't involve too many vertices, and you look at a matrix that, you know, is supposed to be a covariance matrix, then this matrix should be PSD. Okay. So this notation X sub IA is the indicator of the event that the variable X sub I has takes value A. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So we can find something like that, and the question is, you know, if this is useful for solving the Gaussian problem. And the way to rephrase this question is that our goal is now to find variables x1, you know, x prime 1 to x prime n that are, you know, that are jointly distributed, so they are global random variables, and that approximate our local random variables on the edges of the CSP. Okay, and you know, for completeness, you know, think that this imagine that this notation means that the statistical distance between the distribution of the I and J pair is close to the distribution of the IJ pair if you look at the two different sets of variables. Okay, and what I will talk about is an iterative procedure for producing these kind of global random variables given these kind of local random variables. Which works if R is large enough, namely when R is larger than n to the epsilon to the 1/3. Okay, and so doing that will solve the Gaussian problem with parameter epsilon in running time exponential in n to the epsilon to the 1/3. Okay. Is it clear to any questions at this point? Might go to bit too fast. Okay, so this iterative procedure, it has three components, and it's very simple. So the three components are rounding, conditioning, and partitioning. So what is surrounding? Surrounding can mean many things, but you know, for the problem that we want to solve right now, it just means that, you know, we look at the local random variables that we have, and we just you know, ignore all correlations and sample each variable independently according to its marginal. Okay, so this is sort of the kind of very canonical LP rounding. You just sample every variable independently. Then the second component is conditioning, so it means that we pick a vertex j and we sample from a variable x sub j and condition all the other variables on that choice. Okay. And the third thing is partitioning. So it means that so this is the most vague step in all of them. So it means that we want to identify some subset of variables, and we basically want to treat the variables in the subset, in the complement of the subset, independently. So the procedure would you know, I mean, if you go on, it would sort of solve this part independently from this part. So if you want, you can think that it would be recurse on this part and this part. Okay. And so the iterative procedure is that it, you know, it tries to do one of these three things at every step until all the variables are rounded. Okay, and then this is, you know, some kind of randomized procedure, so it will produce global random variables. Okay, and so the goal is to show that these global random variables are approximate our local random variables in a good way. Okay. So and you see, this is a sort of a very general framework that, you know, you don't really use anything about unique games at this point. Okay. So the main ingredient to analyze this running scheme is a notion of pairwise notions of pairwise correlation. In general, correlation between two random variables x sub I and x sub j measures how much the distribution of one of the variables changes if you condition on the other variable. Okay. So how dependent the two variables are. So we want it to be equal to one if one variable determines completely the other variable, and we want it to be equal to zero if the two variables are independent. Okay, so, and concrete measures of correlation that we will use following. So one is essentially the statistical distance between the distribution that we, you know, where we sample the I and j's variable jointly, and the distribution where we sample the I and j's variable independently. Okay, and so you might notice that, you know, if you unroll this, it's not really a statistical distance between the two distributions, but it's for the matter of the talk, it will behave exactly like statistical distance, and it's just, you know, I didn't want to lie too much, so this is what you really want to look at. And in general, the right notion of correlation might depend on the particular CSP that you want to solve. Okay, so this is one way to think about correlation. The other way to think about correlation is that you measure how much the variance decreases when you the variance of the variable x sub I decreases when you condition on the variable x sub j. Okay, so more concretely we look at the variances of these indicator variables versus the variances of the indicator variables after we condition on the jth variable. Okay. And so you might notice, if you remember things from Ning's talk, this is similar to mutual information. The mutual information measures how much the entropy decreases when you condition on one variable, and here we measure how much the variance decreases when you condition on one variable. And so variances are here nicer because we want to argue about these correlations in terms of vectors, and you know, vectors naturally encode variances. And so one important fact that makes the whole thing work is that these correlations, they are really like correlations in the sense that they can be approximated by the Gram matrix of unit vectors, by a Gram matrix of some unit vectors. And so this is actually the only part where we use that that we solve a semi-different programming hierarchy as opposed to a linear programming hierarchy. Okay. And maybe if you sort of a little bit familiar with literature about unit games, but so this is the place where you use the tensoring trick. Okay. Because we are sort of given vectors for these indicator random variables as part of the relaxation, and what we want to have vectors that implement these correlations between vertices, and so we somehow have to mix, have to squash these vectors for the indicator random variables in one vector for the variable. Okay. And now, so given these two notions of correlation, it's we will try to analyze this iterative Fromming scheme. Okay, so let's look at the simple step. So remember that we just wanted to see what happens if we sample every variable independently. Okay. So the claim is that if the correlation between two random variables is not too large to is bounded away from one, then if we sample and there's a constraint between these two random variables which is satisfied with probability 1 minus epsilon, then if we sample the two variables independently, then we will satisfy the constraint between the two variables with probability epsilon. No, I mean, if the correlation is zero, then in some sense, it's even more true. So it's not, this order is just it's like a 10. So it's not like 1/100. In general, order means, large numbers. Omega means small numbers. Let's see why that's the case. It's just, it follows immediately by using the first definition of correlation. Okay, so the one thing I forgot to say is that we will treat these two notions of correlation as the same. So that they're not exactly the same, but they are very close to each other. And for the the two notions of correlation that I had on this slide. Somehow I can't go back. Okay. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I might complain with my employer and after the talk. Okay, so I wrote that. Okay, let's see. Yeah, you missed the best part. Okay, so we had this. Sorry. So we have these notions, two notions of correlation, and we will treat them as being the same. They're not exactly the same, but there's some inequality between them, and it will be in the right direction so that we can pretend they are the same. Okay. And okay, so what we wanted to see is why, if the correlation between the variables is small, then independent sampling satisfies the constraint with good probability. So that's because the correlation measures the statistical distance between, sampling the distribution jointly and sampling it independently. So this condition means that the statistical distance is less than 1 minus, 100 times epsilon. But on the other hand, we know that we satisfy the constraint with probability 1 minus epsilon. Okay. So it means that, there has to be at least, some chance of, like, actually 99 times epsilon where we satisfy the constraint. Okay, if the statistical distance between two distributions is not too close to one, and something happens with probability very close to one, then this, even if you sample from the other distribution, then this event will still happen with some reasonable probability. Okay, and this is exactly the kind of thing that we want for, to solve unit games with probability epsilon. We want to satisfy the constraints with probability epsilon, roughly. Okay. Now to summarize this, we get that if this step fails, in the sense that we don't get a assignment that satisfies an epsilon fraction of the constraints, then we have then this condition also has to fail for most of the constraints. And that means that if we sample an edge from the constraint graph, then the correlation between the two variables is very close to one. Okay. So the surrounding step fails only if the correlation, if these correlations are very close to one across the edges. And we will refer to this as local correlation, having high local correlation. Okay. So that's how okay. So that's how we can analyze the surrounding procedure in terms of these correlations. And now about conditioning. So the problem, in some sense, conditioning is exactly what you want to do, right? If you would condition, if you would sample, n variables, and if you would condition sort of n times on different variables, then you would sample from the distribution exactly. Okay, so what's the problem with conditioning? The problem is with conditioning is that it's computationally very expensive, in the sense that if you condition on a variable, then what you're left with are no longer r local variables, but r minus one local variables. So essentially you destroyed one level of the hierarchy if you condition, and so that means that you want to avoid conditioning too often. Okay, because the number of condition and the number of times you condition is exactly related to the hierarchy, the level of the hierarchies, the levels of the hierarchy that you need. So how can we avoid conditioning on conditioning too often? And the way we can avoid this is by again by looking at correlations. Okay, so the claim is that suppose we condition on vertices only if their correlation with sort of the typical other variable is larger than n to the minus beta for some beta. Then we claim that in this, if we only do that, then if we condition only in this case, then in total we condition at most n to the beta times. The reason is that So see that we use the other way of thinking about correlation, namely that it measures the decrease in the variance when we condition on a variable. Okay, so what does it mean? So if you condition on a vertex j that satisfies this condition, it means that the variances of the variables x sub I, they decrease by n to the minus beta. And so if you would condition more than n to the beta times, the variances would be less than zero, which is not possible. Okay. And so maybe I should say that initially all the variances were one. Okay. And so whenever we condition, we, in this kind of situation, we decrease the variance by some significant amount, so we cannot condition too often. Okay, so. Now, so it means that we only this condition only fails if you're in a situation where the typical pair of vertices has very small correlation. Okay. And so we will refer to the correlation between two typical variables as the global correlation. Okay. So the summary of this slide is that if the conditioning fails, then we have very small global correlation. Okay. So now about the third step, partitioning. So the general problem with partitioning is that if we treat the variables in S independently from the variables in the complement, then we destroy the information that in the edges that go across the two sets, that go between the two sets. Okay, so essentially we lose these constraints, and the goal is that we in total we don't want to break more than half of the constraints using partitioning. Right. So in general, if you're interested in solving any games, it's fine to delete half of the constraints. What you're already left with is still a good instance of unit games. And so the goal here in this partitioning is that we don't want to remove more than half of the constraints in total. Okay, and one way to ensure this is that we only partition if the set is has small expansion, which means that the number of edges that go out is only a small fraction of the total number of edges that are touching the set. And we also want that the set has small cardinality. Okay. The small cardinality essentially ensures that we don't recurse, that we don't partition too often. Okay. Now how can we, how can we hope to find such sets? So remember, we only have to find such sets if the other two steps of the rounding procedure fail. Okay, and we said that the simple rounding fails only if we have high local correlation, and we said that the conditioning fails only if we have very small global correlation. And so what we want to do here now in this slide, so this will be the end of the proof, is to show that if these two conditions are satisfied, then we can find a small set that doesn't expand. Okay. And that will finish the proof, because if this condition is not satisfied, then we can round. If this condition is not satisfied, then we can condition. If both of these conditions are satisfied, then we can partition in this way. Now the main ingredient here is that we argue that correlation propagates. Okay. So somehow we want to extract from these two information something about the constraint graph, and what we can extract is that if you look at the correlation between two variables that are at distance t, then their correlation is at least 1 minus epsilon to the t. Okay. So this is a simple kind of calculation, and here it uses crucially the fact that these correlations are actually inner products of vectors. So this is a very intuitive fact, right? That if edges had correlation 1 minus epsilon, then if you take t, a path along t edges, then their correlation is 1 minus epsilon to the t. Okay. Now what does this mean? This means that if we choose the number of steps to be beta over epsilon times log n, then this correlation between vertices at distance t is much larger than n to the minus beta. Okay, but we know that globally the correlation is much less is less than n to the minus beta, so it's much smaller than this number, and so that means that the random walk, the t-step random walk in this graph, it mixes very poorly. Okay. So only in this situation can it happen that this correlation is very far from this correlation, and now we can use things that we know about random walks and their mixing time. So we know that if you have an expander, then you're supposed to mix in log n steps. Okay, and here we see that you take much more than log n steps, and you don't mix in a very strong sense. So it means certainly that we are not an expander, and therefore there's a set that has small expansion. Okay, so we know that about the constraint graph, and actually we know a little bit more. We know that the random walk it's just not that it didn't mix, but it mixed in it's sort of it's very far from having mixed. The random walk is really concentrated on a very small fraction of the vertices. And this allows us to say that the set, there is a set that doesn't expand, which is very small, which only occupies n to the minus beta over 2 fraction of the constraints. And so this is exactly the kind of property that we wanted from this set. It's small and has small expansion. And now let's think about how many edges we cut in total if we only partition using sets that have these two properties. So the way to think about it is that if you look at a typical vertex in the graph, then whenever the set S that we use to partition contains this vertex, we remove this fraction of edges from the graph. Okay, from the vertex, sorry. We remove the root epsilon of a beta fraction of the edges of this vertex. So this is one thing. Now, how often does the vertex contained in these sets that we use to partition the graph? The point is that, you know, whenever a vertex was contained in one of these sets, the component of that vertex shrank by a factor of n to the beta. Okay, because this here is not really the number of all vertices, but really more like the size of the component that we are just looking at. And so at each of these steps, the component decreases by n to the beta over 2 factor. So that means that, you know, if we do it more than 2 over beta times, then we would isolate this vertex. Okay. So it means that we touch every vertex at most 2 over beta times. Every time we touch, we only remove like this kind of this fraction of edges from the vertex. So overall, we only remove this fraction of edges from a typical vertex. And now you see that if you choose beta as epsilon to the 1/3, then you remove less than, you know, you only remove a small fraction of. So if you choose beta larger than epsilon to the 1/3, then you only remove a small fraction of edges. Okay, so this is the overview of the algorithm, the sub-exponential algorithm for any games. And now maybe some kind of extensions or follow-up results on this algorithm. So one thing is that, you know, this partitioning is sort of messy, so it would be nice if you could avoid this partitioning. So, you know, if you just, you know, do rounding and conditioning, it is, it's much simpler. And it turns out that there's reasonably nice family of instances where you can avoid this partitioning, and these instances are characterized by having a small number of large eigenvalues. So let me explain this. So let me explain this. Okay. Or maybe just before. So remember that, you know, we wanted to do the partitioning only if we had large local correlation and small global correlation. Okay, and it turns out that having large local correlation and having small global correlation implies that the constraint graph has many eigenvalues that are larger than the bound on the local correlation. Okay. And so if you know that your constraint graph doesn't satisfy this property, then you know that, you know, you can never get into this situation, and means that you can always condition on a vertex or just round the graph. Okay. And now what are the consequences of this? So one thing is that, so you can say the following: if you want to solve in against the primary epsilon, then R levels of our STP hierarchy suffice to solve instances where the constraint graph has at most epsilon times R eigenvalues that are larger than 1 minus epsilon. This is improves the result of Koller, which had a more complicated condition on the constraint graph. Okay. And so the reason for that is that if you want to have this kind of So remember, for unigames, we only in trouble the rounding phase only if the local correlation was larger than 1 minus epsilon. And if you're shooting for R rounds, R levels of the hierarchy, then we can condition as long as the correlation is larger, as the global correlation is larger than 1 over R. Okay, so we're only in trouble if the correlation is less than 1 over R. But now this here implies that if we have local correlation larger than 1 minus epsilon and global correlation less than 1 over R, then we have more than R eigenvalues that are larger than 1 minus epsilon. Okay. Another consequence is that one can have new approximation schemes for problems like maxcut. So suppose we want to find the optimal maxcut up to an epsilon fraction of the edges. And what you can say is that if you use R levels of some SDP hierarchy and the graph, and your MaxCut graph has at most eta times R eigenvalues are larger than eta, then you can achieve this kind of approximation. Okay, and the reason is that if you're shooting for an approximation that that preserves the value up to eta, then the rounding fails only if the local correlation is larger than eta. Okay. So previously it was larger than 1 minus epsilon, but now we only know that it's sort of larger than some small number. And on the other hand, if you're shooting for R levels of the hierarchy, we know that in the conditioning phase, we know that the correlation is less, global correlation is less than 1 over R. Okay, now this relation between this connection to eigenvalues tells us that in this situation, the constraint graph has more than eta times R eigenvalues, so they're larger than eta. And maybe one thing that's interesting about this is that if you look at the hard the canonical hard instances from MaxCut, then you have only a polylogarithmic number of large eigenvalues. So eigenvalues are larger than eta for any eta. And so it means that on these kind of instances, a polylogarithmic number of levels of the hierarchy finds a very good approximation to the MaxCut. Yes, right. And yes, exactly. So in particular, so this kind of result it subsumes the results for dense or pseudo dense instances. Okay. So maybe some more remarks. So what I said about unigames, that MaxCut it also applies to general 2CSP, and but there are sort of some kind of subtle things that change. But one particular consequence that you can have is that if a constraint graph is random and its degree is significantly larger than the alphabet size, then you can have a polynomial time approximation scheme using SDP hierarchies. And then this holds for any 2CSP. Okay. Now there are some subsequent works, which so one by Arora and Gerv, which applied our framework to three coloring, and they show how to get better approximations for three coloring on some interesting families of graphs. And okay, this another work is what Ning talked about for better approximations from max bisection. And there's also an independent work which gives a similar framework for rounding SDP hierarchies. And the problems that they considered were something that they showed was our approximation schemes for quadratic integer programming, where the objective function is a positive semi-definite matrix, and this matrix has only few significant eigenvalues. And these conditions, they show how to give approximation schemes for general quadratic integer programs. Okay. Some open questions. So one open question is whether the sub-exponential algorithm for unigames can be extended to other problems. In particular, candidates are MaxCut, VertexCut, and SparseCut. So one concrete possibility is that there's a constant vector approximation for SparseCut, whose running time is exponentially n to the epsilon, where epsilon depends on the kind of approximation that you want.
This is related to what Boas talked about on Sunday. So what does this say about the unigames conjecture? So somehow it says that, if the unigames conjecture is true, then you really want the hard instances to have a polynomial number of large eigenvalues. And so a concrete question is, finding SDP integrality gaps that have polynomial number of large eigenvalues. And of course, this question is you have to be a bit careful what it means to be an SCP integrality gap. One thing is that you don't want to give many disjoint instances, so that would be cheating. So what you want is that somehow these instances, they should be minimal in a sense, so they can't be broken into smaller pieces. And one good way to say that is that we want these instances to be small set expanders. Okay, and then the question becomes: are there small set expanders that have a polynomial number of large eigenvalues, which is exactly the question that was talked about, and we showed that there are instances that have a quasi polynomial number of large eigenvalues. Okay, thank you. So for unique games, it doesn't seem to help. But for unique games, actually, it's better to instead of sort of sampling every variable independently, you would just sample just take the label that has the largest probability in your distribution. That gives a general better approximations for the kind of problem we looked at. It doesn't make a difference. But in principle, any kind of simple, so in these three steps, what I mean by meant by rounding is sort of any kind of standard rounding that you can think of. So also hyperplane rounding falls into this. And hyperplane rounding, you can use hyperplane rounding kind of things or Cheeger inequality kind of things to improve, like in this, I guess, okay, maybe I can say this. In this time versus approximation trade-off that I mentioned, if you want to get the right, the best trade-off, then you want to use more careful rounding, which is sort of a bit like Cheeger or Gibbons-Williamson. But yeah, the simplest way is to do independent rounding.